DW Inside Europe.
Hello and welcome. I'm Kate Laycock in Germany. This week on the show,
the soldier takes the carnation from her and puts it in the barrel of his rifle. And the crowd sees this happen and surges and invades the flower stalls in Roussillon.
Audio guide to the revolution. Join us for a journey through time and space as we visit the streets of revolutionary Lisbon. And
I'd say now it's a moment where we're at the crossroads when it comes to the Green Deal. And that will depend also on the results of the elections.
The EU's Green Deal is in trouble. Time to delve deeper into this flagship policy with far-reaching consequences for Europe and beyond. April 25th marks the 50th anniversary of Portugal's Carnation Revolution, which ended over 40 years of fascist control in the country. In the space of just a few hours, a group of junior officers achieved the total surrender of the Portuguese government, thereby toppling Europe's oldest dictatorship and ending a brutal colonial war. Whether they knew it or not, those officers were building on years of organising by civilian anti-fascists, and it is to those men and women who carried the torch during Portugal's long night that a new book, The Carnation Revolution, The Day Portugal's Dictatorship Fell, is dedicated. Its author is Alex Fernandes, a lighting designer for contemporary theatre groups such as Forced Entertainment. The seeds of Alex's book began in 2021, when he took a group of friends on a guided tour of the sites of revolutionary Lisbon. And that, albeit remotely, is exactly what Alex is going to do for us now.
25th of April, 1974. I think I would start that day in a square just by the river called Praça do Comércio, also known as Terreiro do Paço. And the reason I would start it there is because that's where a cavalry convoy led by Salgueiro Maia, who was a key figure in the revolution, he'd just driven the 90 kilometres from Santarém, which is northeast of Lisbon, and his mission was to occupy the ministerial and government buildings, among others, in this square. And I think this is really where the revolution properly began, because Salgueiro Maia gets to this square around 5 a.m. Nobody really knows that the revolution is underway. But by the time the sun has risen, the armed forces movement, which is leading the revolution, has put out a statement on radio saying their intentions for the country and asking the population to stay indoors, and the population refuse. They're pouring out onto the streets to see what's going on, but also in this kind of moment of jubilation. You can actually walk the route up Rua Augusta, up to Roussillon Square, where the revolution got its name, because there was a woman named Celeste Cairo, who was sent home from work because her boss thought it was best to close the restaurant because there was a revolution going on. And she happened to have a handful of carnations in her hand. And as the story goes, when the soldiers were making their way up from Praça do Comércio through Roussillon, a soldier asks her, "Can I have a cigarette?" And she says, "I don't have a cigarette. All I have is these carnations." And the soldier takes the carnation from her and puts it in the barrel of his rifle. And the crowd sees this happen and surges and invades the flower stalls in Roussillon, where carnations were in season, and begins handing them out to the soldiers and the officers who were doing the revolution. And that's why it's called the Carnation Revolution. I think the next stop on the tour would be Carmo Square, which is around the corner from Roussillon Square. It's up a hill, and there's a couple of important things there. One, there's a monument to Captain Salgueiro Maia, who led this convoy. And there's also the military police barracks, where Prime Minister Marcelo Caetano was being held when the revolution took place. He was being held there for his safety. And there's a quite spectacular and moving siege that takes place, where Salgueiro Maia finds himself unable to not open fire on this building. And there's a couple of things that happen over the course of this siege that change history slightly and mean that it didn't end up being this shooting war that everyone feared it would come down to between the regime soldiers inside the building and the kind of revolutionary captains. Eventually, the Prime Minister surrenders. But this square is a hugely important square for the revolution and for Portuguese history. And there is, as I said, a plaque in honour of Captain Salgueiro Maia at this location. So that's, I think, the next stop in the tour. The 25th of April was obviously only the beginning of the Carnation Revolution. It was the coup that then spilled out into a popular revolt. The revolutionary period also has a lot of deeply important elements to the present Portugal and its meaning. But I think that the city of Lisbon sort of exploded in a way that was unprecedented, and there was a massive upsurge of popular movements, of building occupations and of workplace occupations and of autonomous collectives that turned Lisbon into what some people referred to as the Lisbon Commune. And when that happened, the streets were filled with street art and there were murals everywhere, and there were every single corner seemed to have something important and crucial happening on it. And so I kind of struggle to think of like a specific location that really represents what that is, because every single cobble, every single building, every single park was being used for something extremely relevant.
Alex Fernandes is the author of The Carnation Revolution, The Day Portugal's Dictatorship Fell, which is out with One World Publications. And honestly, I cannot recommend this book enough. Now, whilst we're in the business of time travel...
This is a very special day. This morning, the College of Commissioners agreed on the European Green Deal.
The sound there of another kind of history being made. EU Commission President Ursula von der Leyen back in 2020 announcing the launch of the EU's Green Deal, the flagship environmental and economic policy, which she described as the bloc's man on the moon moment. Fast forward to today, however, and the deal is in trouble. Big trouble. This week, Philippe Lambert, the co-leader of the Green Group of MEPs in Brussels, warned that the project, which has informed everything from tax to environmental policy, is at very high risk of being killed off completely should the far right, as predicted, make significant gains in June's parliamentary elections. Already, the Green Deal has been significantly depleted, with plans to halve pesticide use, ban toxic forever chemicals, and rein in livestock emissions either watered down or shelved. A crucial nature restoration law, which would restore nature to 20% of Europe's land and seas, hangs in the balance. High time, then, for us to take a closer look at the Green Deal, what it is, what it isn't, and what it could be. A quick Green Deal 101 first. To get an overview of what this often nebulous-feeling policy really is in practice, I reached out to Romain Padeau, Programme Manager at the EU Office of the Cambridge Institute for Sustainability Leadership.
So if we go back in a time machine and look back at the moment where the Green Deal became the flagship initiative of the European institutions, it came from necessity. It came from a moment where climate was at the forefront of the political debate, but also the civil society debate. There were a lot of youth demonstrations in favor of climate in the run-up to the EU elections. So I think the Green Deal really captured all of this, which is the need to really deal with the climate crisis, the nature crisis, and lead to the economic transformation of the EU.
Maybe you could help me get a grip on those objectives. If you had to sort of break down the project for me into key planks, what would those key planks be?
So the Green Deal is very comprehensive. So it's about economic transformation as a whole across all sectors. First, it's the roadmap towards climate neutrality by 2050. It is about setting targets for climate, but it's also about safeguarding biodiversity and nature, establishing a circular economy, and also there's the economic angle, which is it's the growth strategy for the EU. And so one of the objectives of the Green Deal is really to boost competitiveness and the growth across the entire economy.
So those are the objectives. What about the implementation? What were the mechanisms that were in place to make sure that governments and also businesses acted in line with the policies that were being set out?
So the Green Deal is unprecedented also in scope. It is a lot of different legislative files. So it actually took the whole legislature to agree on some of the political files. So if we look at what's within the Green Deal, there's the target setting. So the idea that the Green Deal is a compass towards climate and nature objectives. So within the Green Deal, there are objectives to achieve climate neutrality by 2050, which is inscribed now into EU law, but also a target to reduce emissions reductions by at least 55% by 2030. There are provisions also to safeguard nature, against with targets for biodiversity protection. And it touches upon transport. So there are provisions on phasing out the internal combustion engine, for example, and also targets to increase renewable energy and energy efficiency. So you have the target setting on one side, and then you have the enabling framework, which is about how do we invest in the economy to achieve these objectives. And so there is also an industry component with a Net Zero Industry Act, which is looking into how to boost competitiveness and clean technologies across Europe.
Am I right in sort of understanding that every national government gets to kind of pick its own pathway through this? It gets to decide the targets are there, and it gets to decide what it does in order to meet them.
So member states are required, for example, to put national energy and climate plans together, which will determine how they reach climate-related objectives, for example. And what we have seen is that member states have different challenges depending on how they can reduce their emissions. So for some member states, reducing emissions from certain sectors is more challenging than in other member states. So for example, when it comes to transport and agriculture emissions.
So, I mean, thinking of the Netherlands as an example, there are a concentration on nitrogen because of the big agricultural sector and the way in which that then becomes a focus for pushbacks from farmers who feel that they're being unfairly targeted.
If we look at the gaps of the Green Deal, one of them is nature for the moment, which means that member states are yet to put their final rubber stamp of agreement on the nature restoration law. And this has been a divisive issue for member states. And it has been a difficult file to push forward, given pushback from farmers in the run-up to the European elections. But we're hopeful that there will be a successful outcome to this.
Romain Pardoux, Programme Manager at the EU Office of the Cambridge Institute for Sustainability Leadership, setting us up there for the programme to come as we attempt to unpack the EU's Green Deal. That's here on Inside Europe with me, Kate Laycock in Germany. The Green Deal may be in trouble, but might this crisis contain within it the seeds of an opportunity? That is what my next guest is hoping. Her name is Sophie Augent, and she is Director of Global Advocacy at Fairtrade International. Send Sophie back in a time machine to the launch of the EU's Green Deal, and she would have told you from the start that, from her perspective, the programme was flawed from the beginning. Too Europe-focused, too lacking in policies to address the global injustices of climate change, and with too little attention paid to the bloc's social responsibilities, both at home and abroad. Now, she believes, the way to save the EU's Green Deal is to reimagine it, which is why Fairtrade International and partners have issued an action call, arguing that it is time to turn the EU's Green Deal into a global Green Deal.
We're making this call to action as part of the Fairtrade movement overall and also with the NGO Solidar. So there are five key areas of recommendations we have. The first one is really around boosting long-term finance. So climate finance, I think a lot of people heard about the loss and damage fund, for instance, but also finance to support the transition to agroecology. And this is also really key. So it's not only about climate. It's also about sustainable agriculture in general that needs financial and technical support. And we want also to make sure that this finance is accessible to SMEs and to smallholder farmers in an easy way. And then the second big ask is around a just transition strategy. So we want really the EU to enable the creation of decent jobs, not only within Europe, but also with its EU partner countries. We want really to put the issue of living income and living wage on the political agenda, both of the EU and of other governments. And this is around paying fair prices. There have been, you know, a lot of farmers' demonstrations in Europe over the last month. And one of the key things they are asking for is to get fairer prices. And this is true exactly in the same way for farmers outside Europe. So we want this to be at the top of the next European Commission agenda. As a third ask, we also want to see a reform of EU trade policies. So for instance, you know, there is Mercosur, this agreement on which there are a lot of ideological discussions. And I think what really matters there is to be able to assess really the impact it's going to have. So it's really important that the EU does much more assessment of the impact of free trade agreements and economic partnership agreements. And then also, of course, we want to see what could be potentially the role of fair trade into those policies. So for instance, there could be a mandatory criteria of fair trade in public procurement, for instance, for food in public school canteens. And perhaps the last point that we're making with this call to action is broader, and I think is also of interest of many EU citizens, and is around transforming the EU economic model.
Sophie Augent, Director of Global Advocacy at Fairtrade International, with that manifesto for a global Green Deal. Now, that call for a rethinking of the economic model is something that is likely to strike a chord with the Spanish organisation Justicia Alimentaria, which has launched a campaign called Our Markets Are Dying to raise awareness of the problems faced by local municipal markets. Inside Europe, Sashish Sharma visited the San Fernando market in Madrid and met up with Jody Menendez, Erin McNulty and Alicia Silvia from Justicia Alimentaria.
Well, I'm in the Mercado San Fernando for a market in the morning. There's only two stalls that are open selling food. One is a fruit shop and another one is like a butcher's. And the rest of the market is closed because it's full of bars, and these bars won't open until much later on. And I'm joined now by Justicia Alimentaria, the organisation, which is called Food Justice. Thank you very much for taking time to talk to Inside Europe and Deutsche Welle. Let's start with you, Erin. What is your organization all about?
Our organization is an organization formed by people that want to change the global food system. We think that the way of the food and agriculture is working today in days, it does not respond to people's needs to guarantee the right to food and to guarantee a sustainable and just agriculture system. We work in different places around the world with different campaigns and different projects.
Yeah, I'm glad you mentioned the word campaign, because we're really here talking about a campaign that you've launched, which is all about saving markets. What is the thinking behind this campaign?
Municipal markets are dying in Spain at the moment. They're dying, they're closing, and they do not respond to actual food necessities. They are not spaces where people are guaranteed a right to food. They are spaces for tourists, to come for nightlife, but they are no longer spaces to actually get the right to a sustainable and to a healthy, fresh food produce, which is what they were originally for.
Alethea, I'll turn to you now, because you live here. So how personal is this to you, and what we're seeing today? I mean, it's mid-morning, midweek, a marketplace should be bustling.
It's so sad for me, because I've been living here, I've been buying my food here, and I can no longer do that. And well, I have been using this space also for a cooperative of agroecologic vegetables, and we used to use this space for distribution of vegetables. We couldn't use this space no longer, because the people who manage this space, they didn't want us to be here.
Turning to you, Jordi, why is it that we have this situation?
San Fernando is one of those examples, but you can find the same problem in other cities, Barcelona, Madrid, Valencia. This kind of markets they are changing the use, especially the markets that are in the center of the cities. No,
I mean, the European Union has its Green Deal, but also this Green Deal going local. Are you aware of this? Is this something that you can work with?
No, actually, well, we do know about the Green Deal, and we agree with the Green Deal, but we haven't heard about the program, the Going Local program. First time we heard talk about that. But definitely, if it's going to work and if it's actually going to make the Green Deal go local, it should involve municipal markets. Because at the moment, the markets are in a control where they're partially public and partially private. And if it's the private enterprise that just wants to make money. And for example, Spain has a recently approved national food strategy. Well, this national food strategy should include their local markets, because they exist in all the cities, all the towns, as points to guarantee local access to food. And at the moment, the food national food strategy is only thinking about exporting food, and it's not thinking about feeding the local population.
While the campaign has been positively received, it has also faced criticism for using images of decaying fruit. Cristobal Aguado, president of the Association of Valencian Agriculturists, says this is the worst way of promoting Spanish products.
It's truly regrettable to see an advertising campaign that reinforces the problems at municipal markets by relying on fruit grown in our country, which is often rotten. That's offensive to agricultural producers.
It's lunchtime. The bars and food stalls in this marketplace are in full swing now. It's mainly tourists who are wandering in, deciding where to eat and drink. This will now be the scene for this market till it closes late at night. It's a far cry from its original purpose. And while it's doing well serving its international visitors, the question remains, what is it serving its local community? Ashish Sharma, DW, Madrid.
We have so much more coming up for you after the break as we continue to unpack the thorny topic of the EU's Green Deal, including Danish farm flooding, Slovakian bears, and Italian mafia fraud. If you're listening to the half-hour version of the programme, then you will be able to hear all of those stories via our podcast. For now, though, you're listening to Inside Europe. I'm Kate Laycock in Germany.
Thank you.
This is Inside Europe, and I'm Kate Laycock in Germany. Our Green Deal special continues now as we focus in on the topic of land. Danish land that's been deliberately flooded, Bulgarian land that's been deliberately left untilled, and Italian land that's being bought up by the mafia. Oh yes, and there will be bears. Dangerous bears. Or are they being set up?
The persons that were involved in these incidents were, on a very conspicuous way, all armed with pistols.
Bear with us. That's still to come.
From the studios of Germany's international broadcaster, DW, this is Inside Europe.
Earlier in the programme, we mentioned the EU's nature restoration law, currently hanging in the balance. It is a key element of the EU biodiversity strategy, which called for binding targets to restore degraded ecosystems, in particular those with the most potential to capture and store carbon. How might that be done? Well, Denmark, which is poised to introduce the world's first carbon tax on agriculture, might just be showing the way. Richard Orange went out to rural Jutland to visit Henrik Bertelsen, a farmer who has just flooded three quarters of his land.
It starts here, and I think you can already see that it has gone wetter.
Henrik Bertelsen has spent 9 years trying to do something few farmers would ever want to do: flood three quarters of his land and turn parts of it back to peat bog.
Should we get out and have a look?
Let's do that.
This February, he finally did it, becoming one of the first of Denmark's farmers to re-wet the organic soils drained after the Second World War, preventing them from emitting significant amounts of carbon dioxide. The project is top of the list of measures the country's government hopes will become widespread if it succeeds this summer in bringing in the world's first carbon tax on agriculture.
Planning the project started 9 years ago, and actually doing it started in October last year. In the end, it was to stop all the old drain systems. That was the last thing that was done. It just took a couple of days, and then the water, as I said, it has been raining a lot this winter, so the water just came back in a week or so, and now it's done.
When former peat bogs and other wet and marshy lands are drained, organic matter trapped for thousands of years breaks down and releases carbon dioxide. Living peat bogs, on the other hand, absorb and trap carbon as they grow, making re-wetting drained agricultural lands one of the easiest ways of reducing carbon emissions from agriculture.
They say that about one-third of the total release of carbon dioxide from Danish agriculture comes from these about 100,000 hectares. So you remove about a third of all release of carbon dioxide from Danish agriculture just by taking out these 100,000 hectares. And you know, we have about growing on about 2.5 million hectares, so it's quite a little piece of land you have to take out, and it includes all the carbon dioxide from cattle and pigs and so on. So it's very important.
A 2.5 hour train ride across the island of Funen and over the Little Belt and Great Belt bridges, I'm in Copenhagen, where I meet Mikkel Svare, the economist who has provided Denmark's government with three options for its carbon tax on agriculture. Under the plans, carbon emissions would be taxed at either 750 kroner a ton, 375 kroner a ton, or 125 kroner a ton, with subsidies and other measures increased correspondingly for the two lower tax bands. In all three models, though, subsidies and taxes to incentivise the transformation of lowland soils back into wetland play a key role.
First of all, it's relatively cheap reductions. They have a relatively low economic value and they have a relatively large impact on emissions. So we suggest a continued subsidy, but then with a small tariff of about 10 Danish kroner per tonne of CO2e emission.
I saw that one of the farmers' unions talked about, you know, putting up gallows for
yes.
you.
Yes.
I mean, how do you react to that?
It is kind of a death threat, but it was also said with a glimpse in the eye. So I didn't take it as a literal death threat. But of course, the rhetorics are a little bit harsh when you face people who are risk seeing a lot of their production being hurt by this tax.
Were you expecting some pushback?
Yeah, we were expecting some pushback. But I think that the pushback has been fair, that people are saying, okay, if we're the only country to impose a tax, that's going to harm the competitiveness of Danish farmers vis-a-vis foreign farmers, and that is true. So the point is, of course, that all other countries should also move along the path of regulating these emissions.
Back in Vian, Henrik takes me to visit his neighbour, Martin Jørgensen, a young farmer who is worried that a tax on the emissions from his dairy herd could push him out of business.
So here are your cows. So they're still in now then? Are they grazing?
They are in all year.
Oh, are they?
We feed them inside, yeah.
And so how many cows do you have in here?
We have around 600 cows, yeah.
So the government right now it's had proposals of three different ways of taxing, putting a carbon tax on agriculture. Yes. I mean, can you just tell me about what you think about it?
Yeah. The highest amount we can, on this farm, it will be around 6 million Danish crown in tax for every year. That's not possible. And even though it's the lowest price will be around 1.5 million. And if we have to pay that, well, then the milk price must be on another level. So the thing is that if they put this tax on us, it will only be in Denmark. Mm. And we cannot compete. We almost 80% of our dairy products we export to other countries. So we will have a big challenge there in competing with other farmers around the world.
Do you think that milk production is going to be one of the sectors that's going to have to change the most because of a carbon tax?
Yeah, I think they will, because cows are the animals who has the highest CO2. If we should increase this very much, then we all have to eat chicken every day, and I don't think Henrik wants to do that. But not every day.
When we get back to his farm, Henrik takes me to the place where his land meets Vian Mose, one of the few surviving parts of the peat bogs that used to cover much of Denmark.
If you want to, we can walk around here and then we can see how high the peat bog were older days.
Yeah. Is this where they used to dig?
Yeah. Oh, wow,
so there really is.
I think it's getting lower than it originally was. And all this carbon dioxide stored in these land, that is what has left the area over many, many years. It's hard to imagine how it was in those days.
And that's just in the past 100 years, basically.
Yeah.
So 100 years ago, it was like this, maybe.
About 100 years. Yeah, it was. But with no trees and like walking on a big swamp, the whole area. So that's one of the types of nature. They are very recommendable that we get back, because there are so little left on these types of peat bogs. It will take many years before this looks like that again, but, you know, we have to start one day. I wish I could see this in 1,000 years.
Richard Orange in Vian Mose, Denmark.
Flooding your land is a radical way to promote biodiversity, but by no means the only one. Bulgaria, one of the smallest European countries by area, is also one of its largest cereal producers. No wonder then that the Bulgarian government's strategy for meeting its commitments under EU frameworks is focusing on trying to find more sustainable ways of growing crops. And a small but passionate group of farmers are trailblazers in this field. And yes, that pun was intended. Damian Vodinicharov reports from the banks of the Danube in northern Bulgaria.
The Danube Plain is what you'd call the agricultural heartland of Bulgaria. It is the country's richest soil, and it is where its main crops are grown, that is wheat, corn, and sunflower. Come harvest, the fields are littered with machines gathering these crops, which are the lifeblood of Bulgarian agriculture. Cereal farming has largely benefited from EU subsidies and the free market. In the village of Brest, located a few kilometers south of the Danube, resides one of the country's largest cereal farms. The owner, Pavel Stoimenov, takes me on a tour of his fields, spanning a mind-boggling 10,000 hectares. That is 100 square kilometers of cultivated land. It is easy to lose your sense of orientation with the sharp turns onto a dozen back roads. We finally pull up on a hilltop overlooking the area with a row of trees nearby. Stoimenov takes great pride in the technique he applies to growing his crops, namely no-till farming, a technique that bypasses overturning the soil in favor of planting various bean crops that will produce the nutrients necessary to the main crops, like wheat and corn.
We plant these beans so the tubers are formed in the winter. Then it gets really cold in January. The temperature drops to -5 or -10 degrees. All these cultures freeze up, but the plant has gathered nutrients for us for the next crop. It's all in the soil. We take advantage of that.
No-till farming promotes biodiversity in the soil. It provides an environment that traps moisture and allows microorganisms to thrive. Stoimenov grabs a shovel from the trunk of his car to show me what this means.
Let's dig right here. This soil hasn't been disturbed in 15 years. Here it is. Look at this. You can see the channels dug up by the worms. They're the ones working, instead of tractors. This is the future of our planet, right here.
Practically all of Stoimenov's cereal crops are grown with this no-till technique. The soil is left undisturbed, which prevents erosion, one of the main issues of cereal farming. Stoimenov says it is imperative to preserve the land.
The soils, the climate, they have no chance to survive. Climate warming is obvious to us. So is abnormal rainfall. With this technique, the soil can soak up the water thanks to the channels created by the worms. I recommend this technique to every farmer, really.
Pavel Stoimenov decided to switch to no-till farming almost 20 years ago after a drought hit him hard. He was then inspired by more traditional farming methods he remembered from his childhood in the Pirin Mountains.
I grew up in the mountains, and back in my day, under the communist regime, everything was nationalized. We only had a handful of animals and a small plot of land for personal needs. So my family grew all kinds of crops on this small piece of land, whether it be corn, beans, or even pumpkins. We even plowed the soil. We never used fertilizer. We never used herbicides. And we lived a great life.
Today, of course, things are different. Large-scale farming is impossible without chemicals such as insecticides and fertilizer. The no-till technique makes use of as little fertilizer as possible, says Stoimenov, thus reducing costs significantly. Insecticides remain necessary for the time being, but the future may yet hold a solution to weed-killing chemicals, he says.
Artificial intelligence is the future of farming. We're currently in negotiations with a company that is making a robot with lasers. This robot seeks out weeds and targets them with lasers to burn them away. One of these robots, which is about 6 meters long, can do the work of about 500 people in the field.
Stoimenov remains in the minority in Bulgaria. He supports the Green Deal and the environmental concerns related to farming, but he says only 5% of his colleagues share his views. Farmer communities are also facing another harsh reality, workforce depletion. Cereal crops notably require very few workers. Stoimenov's 9,000 hectares of crops are only overseen by 6 people. He also grows vegetables at a loss, employing hundreds of people who weed out and sort produce. The future may yet hold environmentally friendly solutions that come at a high social cost. Demian Vodenicharov, DW, Brest, Bulgaria.
I'm afraid that's not the last of our ominous warnings this week. Things are about to get sinister as we take a look at what happens when organised crime finds a way to muscle in on EU funding. 10 years ago, so long before the launch of the Green Deal, Professor Calandra of the University of L'Aquila noticed something strange. According to the papers on her desk from the AGEA, the Italian body that distributes European subsidies, the world outside her office should have been teeming with economic activity. But when she looked outside at the flanks of the Apennines, she saw beautiful but deserted mountains. Thus began an investigation which led her to uncover an ingenious mafia system that commits fraud with European money. Angelo van Schaik reports.
Something strange is happening in Abruzzo, the mountainous region in central Italy. In the 1950s and 60s, around 5 million sheep grazed here in the Apennines. And according to the enormous amount of European agricultural subsidies that the Italian region has received, they should still be around. But there are not a sheep to be seen for miles around.
Lei è pastore?
Io?
Sì.
Io dovrei essere pensionato.
Adriana Marama was born and raised in Abruzzo and comes from a farming family. His father and grandfather ran a farm and kept sheep. Until recently, Adriano produced feed for fellow farmers in the region.
This is all public terrain, owned by the local governments. These mountains used to be full of sheep, cows and goats, but now there's nothing. I'm going to take you to a little village where, until just after the Second World War, there were 12,000 sheep and 3,000 cows. You know how many there are today? Zero. None.
Lina Calandra is professor social sciences at the University of L'Aquila. Already 10 years ago, she heard rumors in the region that something strange was going on.
Questi arrivano, prendono in concessione I pastori.
They arrive here and offer a lot of money for the pastures. These are all small municipalities with little money. If a pasture normally costs 1,000 euros and they offer 10,000, it's logical that they win the public tenders.
Who they are becomes clear in one of the many anonymous interviews Calandra did with local farmers.
Ma ci sono dei pascoli, soprattutto comunali, e non assoggettati a vincoli del parco.
They are all people from outside Abruzzo that come here, paying a lot of money for pieces of public land, especially the areas high in the mountains and those without the constraint of the national park rules. Since they have connections with local politicians, who also receive money, they can operate in this way. Then they come and ask me if I would like to tend their sheep.
After a long research, Professor Calandra found out how the system works.
Il modello criminale.
The mafia system works as follows. Fake farms are being set up in southern Italy, headed by young entrepreneurs. Based on the number of hectares declared, they receive so-called titoli, a sort of certificate that entitles them to European subsidies. After a year or two, these certificates are sold to companies in northern Italy and then transferred to land here in Abruzzo, the latter being allowed under Italian law. Those northern Italians lease land here for a lot of money and then receive European subsidies. The more titoli you have, the more hectares of land you need to justify the right to those subsidies. But it's all on paper, all fake.
Driving around, Adriano Marama points out all the farms that are abandoned and fell to ruins.
Non esistono più, non hanno più futuro, non possono avere futuro.
Many farms have gone bankrupt. They have no future. They've been destroyed by this government policy and the presence of the mafia. This was once a garden, but except for a single olive grove, it's all gone wild here. The companies that remained have had to come up with something else because they cannot make a living from agriculture alone. Adopt a sheep. Breed goats for the typical local spiedini, roasted meat on a stick, or they started an agriturismo.
Quanti pecore ha?
Solo con le capre 1800.
1800.
Queste sono le capre, sì.
Sì, stanno un qualcosina.
Nunzio Marcelli runs a farm in Anversa degli Abruzzi, but was forced to adapt to the new reality and transform his company into an agriturismo.
Ma non c'è più. Quindi lei ha una mandria vera e ha anche ricevuto dei.
I also received subsidies based on the yield of my land, about 200 euros per hectare per year. But there are also pieces of land for which you get 800 euros, and intensive livestock farms in the north even get up to 5,000 euros per hectare. Since productivity was disconnected from the land itself, it is possible to transfer that right to European funding to other, less productive and cheaper pieces of land, such as Abruzzo. It's a legalized fraud and the final blow to real farms here.
We finally arrived in San Benedetto Imperilis. Once a rich shepherd's town, now all the farms are closed and most of the houses in town are on sale. All shepherds are gone, just like all the sheep. Adriana shows me documents on his phone that make clear the fraud was massive.
Questi sono sei comuni, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, per un totale di.
Someone got 4.6 million euros of European funding based on those so-called titoli, with the empty meadow we're standing in now. There are supposed to be farms, cows, sheep, but as you can see, there is nothing, just grass.
The big question is, with all that money going around and nothing to justify it, there was no one from one of the towns that had a look, if it was all real. There are no exact data, but the last 20 years, dozens of farms have closed their doors in Abruzzo, notwithstanding the hundreds of millions that arrived in the central Italian region. Despite the warnings from the local farmers and Professor Calandra, no one controlled anything or corrected the law that made this fraud possible. Now the rural region is more and more taken over by criminal organizations that not only make millions of euros from European funding, but also take control of the territory and use it for other purposes, such as drug trade and weapons trade. Another Italian region might fall into the hands of the mafia, while honest farmers struggle to survive. Angelo von Schaik, DW, Abruzzo, Italy.
Be on high alert for mafia fraud and Slovakian bears. Yep, you heard that right. That's coming up here on Inside Europe with me, Kate Laycock in Germany. Earlier this year, Politico produced a handy guide to the wedge issues, pitting people from different European nations against national and EU-level climate policy. Look up Slovakia on that list and you will find that the wedge issue there is bears. There are just over 1,000 brown bears in the country, but the populist nationalist government under Robert Fico has been leading a pressure campaign on Brussels to lift protections on the animals. Rob Cameron reports for us from Prague in the neighbouring Czech Republic or Czechia.
Mŕtva je teda približne 69-kilová trojročná medvedica. Štátna ochrana.
Bear attacks seem to be almost weekly occurrences in Slovakia these days, with the most prominent happening in mid-March. A large brown bear was caught on video bounding through the streets of the town of Liptovský Mikuláš, lashing out at passers-by and leaving several people, including a child, with minor injuries. The government was under pressure to respond, especially with the presidential elections looming, and the Environment Ministry quickly announced proposals to change the constitution to allow bears that strayed into 500-metre exclusion zones on the fringes of inhabited areas to be shot on sight by hunters or the police, rather than going through the arduous paperwork demanded by Slovakia's EU-compliant wildlife protection legislation. Tomáš Taraba is the country's environment minister.
If a bear enters this zone, it's clear the animal has significantly lost its shyness, and therefore there's an increased risk of an encounter with a human. If a bear finds itself in this zone, it will then be possible to dispose of it automatically without launching an official procedure. We're submitting an amendment to the Constitution rather than a regular law to prevent NGOs from going to the Constitutional Court to block it.
It quickly transpired the government of Robert Fico didn't have enough votes in Parliament to secure the necessary constitutional majority, and so the proposal has been withdrawn for consultations. Slovakia affords the highest levels of protection to its brown bear population. This was true even before the country joined the EU in 2004. The population had steadily grown from a low point of some 20 animals after the Second World War to an estimated cohort of perhaps 1,000 bears, although hunters insist the true number is far higher, perhaps five times higher. Several dozen were shot each year with the required official permits. But when Slovakia joined the EU, it also signed up to the Natura 2000 directive, and Bratislava specifically asked Brussels for bears to be placed within so-called Annex 5, or strictly protected species, so quotas for annual culls are no longer possible at all. Dangerous bears can be killed in specific circumstances, and it was these that the government cited when it said it had tracked down and killed the Liptovský Mikuláš bear, but not everyone is convinced.
That was so obvious. Like, with 90% accuracy, I can tell you that the bear that was recorded within Liptovský Mikuláš was really somewhere around 80, 100 kilometers male specimen. What they shot was a female specimen.
Michal Viezik is an MEP for the opposition Progressive Slovakia, but he's also an environmental scientist and an expert in nature protection. He says the real reason for the sharp rise in the incidence of bear attacks is not, as the hunters claim, a jump in numbers, but provocative human behavior.
So the last month, there were like 4 attacks reported. All of them happened in remote areas. So inside of a forest, inside of a natural habitat of a bear. So it was not in the vicinity of human settlements. It was really in remote forest areas where the persons that were involved in these incidents were, on a very conspicuous way, all armed with pistols. And they used those pistols within that incident.
The issue has now died down somewhat, now that a new president has been elected and the Fico government is distracted with other matters. Michal Viezik is still waiting for evidence the authorities shot the right bear. He says there's a wall of silence on the issue, and the media is waiting for the next encounter between man and the European brown bear. For DW, this is Rob Cameron in Prague.
A quick message of solidarity here to our colleagues at Slovakia's public broadcaster RTVS, who are protesting in response to the news this week that it is to be shut down and replaced with an organisation under tighter government control. We'll have more on that story next week. Also, a reminder that the environmental deep dive continues over on our sister podcast, Living Planet. That's it for this week. The programme was produced by me, Kate Laycock, with lots of help from Nick Martin and sound engineers Jürgen Kuhn and Jörg Morawetz. Inside Europe comes to you from DW in Bonn, Germany.